So maybe the first question to start with, this is your first time in Slovenia, and I understand it was partially, the gig is going to happen partially on your own initiative. So how come you decided to play in Slovenia?
For one thing, it's not my first time in Slovenia, but it's my first time in Ljubljana.
So where did you stay before?
Very beautiful city. Mm-hmm. I've traveled through a couple of times, once from Hungary to Riga and into the Istria Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And then once, a couple of years ago, we came across from in Gorizia, mm-hmm. and went straight up the mountains on the Slovenian side, mm-hmm. all the way to mm-hmm. To the lock nearby. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've been to Ljubljana before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Performing or as a
tourist? No, just visiting. Mm-hmm. But from staying in a place on the Slovenian-Italian border called Topolo, which mm-hmm. there's a summer artist residency program every July, and mm-hmm. we came mm-hmm. with some Dutch and American artists. We came mm-hmm. for a day.
Mm-hmm. And how did you decide to perform here in Slovenia?
I just was in a sort of very academic conference about film, mm-hmm. in long and interesting, and didn't allow much sleep. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to come to Venice afterwards, and so we wrote to a friend who lives in London, mm-hmm. Matteo Leger, and so he arranged this concert.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, how do you usually choose what countries you're going to perform in? Because you travel quite a bit, do you just interested in the sightseeing of the particular country or maybe the music side?
Well, frequently they're chosen for me by the act. Most of the time I get performances because somebody asked me to do it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I write letters, and I tour a lot with another composer, Thomas Anker-Schmidt, mm-hmm. and he writes a lot of letters. So if we do a tour together, it's usually he's booking things. But, mm-hmm. but most of the time, like this, I was invited to Gorizia. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I had just done a concert in Antwerp mm-hmm. last weekend. Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to do a concert together during like the next 2 weeks. And in Venice, when we began asking people, we know it was too late, and we began thinking, also, like what's close to mm-hmm. nice. Venice and Gorizia, and then we remembered we had our mm-hmm. friend Metod in Ljubljana.
Right.
And Phil had never been to Ljubljana, so he didn't wanted to come to see Ljubljana for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So maybe if we move to your music, I remember reading about Todd Dockstader, who's probably your contemporary. He got interested in this, doing sound art through broadcast frequencies, radio broadcast frequencies. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. there is Eliane Radik, who got interested because she lived next to the airport and was listening to planes taking off.
Mm-hmm.
And I read somewhere that you got interested in a highway when you were driving behind a truck in a motorcycle. So how does one go mm-hmm. from such an occurrence to devote their life, basically, or their career to exploring this sort of thing?
I think the motorcycle story was a little bit strange. But I was very interested in drums and getting rid of the normal structure of music. Mm-hmm. So to not have rhythm and not have melody and to not have a typical harmonic progressions, or essentially not to have development. So that was also a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested to work with various close intervals, which would produce different harmonics, so that it would interact and produce a different harmonic spectrum that one mm-hmm. hears in the space.
This was influenced when you saw the performance of Morton Feldman music. Is that the time when you got interested? Or
that particular piece was all long tones, and mm-hmm. it was without any obvious melody or rhythm. And unlike anything else of Feldman's, it was for a short period of time when he made those pieces, in 1961. And I happened to hear the premiere, I'm pretty sure it was the premiere of a sort of major piece with a larger ensemble.
So it's maybe that the time that you got interested in music, to that point that you started on your own? Or?
Well, it was somewhere in the middle. That piece sort of gave me permission, in some sense, to make music that didn't have rhythm, melody, and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I began to listen to music really in 1948 and began to collect records.
Mm-hmm. This was jazz music?
And I was a jazz, and I just bought in this jazz and blues record shop a jazz CD. Mm-hmm.
So
today. So. Today.
You're interested in music, started with jazz?
It started with jazz, but I've listened to a lot of classical music, and I was always trying to find contemporary music. And I was studying in the 50s at Indiana University, which had a huge music department. And I didn't study music, but I went to a lot of concerts. And of course, they were mostly not contemporary music. They were classical music. And it was at the time very hard to find any contemporary music, and it's especially hard to find any experimental contemporary music. You can find academic contemporary music, and in fact, I didn't even know about what experimental stuff was, and it turned out that that Feldman piece was as close as I could as I got to experimental.
So you first got in touch with the experimental side when you moved to New York.
Yes, this Feldman concert was in New York. I moved to New York in 1958, and I immediately began to hear a lot of jazz, of course, in clubs, but I also went to a lot of classical music concerts, both more contemporary and also not so contemporary.
So, do you maybe remember when at what time or when did you learn the most about music? Some particular event that...
No, I don't think so. I just, when I began to collect, I began to listen fairly seriously, and then I listened to as much stuff as I could, either live or particularly recorded, because I grew up in Atlanta, and there was very little contemporary music or music, other than pop music or country music. The Indiana was saturated with only that, so it was very hard to hear anything. Even jazz was weird. And it's because I chanced across a man who had a record store who was the major influence. So I bought records from his record store, and he was a jazz fan as well as a classical fan. And so his influence was really incredible.
But what about, you've talked about the subscription you had to contemporary concerts at one point, when in your early years in New York, and that you went to see a lot of contemporary, and you said you saw Cage then, and all these people.
Well, it wasn't really a subscription. I went just to see a lot of music.
And this was before the experimental intermediate project.
Sorry.
This thing, you visited all these experimental gigs before you started with Experimental Intermedia Foundation.
Experimental Intermedia was actually, all of this was happening in the 60s, so I heard the Feldman stuff in 61, and I started to do, I was doing photography, and at the time I was also photographing a lot of jazz musicians, so, and then in 65 I began to work with a filmmaker and choreographer, Elaine Summers, and began to see more and more of the experimental work, particularly in dance, but art. I went to a lot of galleries all through the 60s, and to a lot of experimental films, and to theater performances.
And Elaine Summers was the founder of Experimental Intermedia.
Elaine Summers founded Experimental Intermedia in 1968. And I was a member artist, but I was also the other person who was producing stuff at the same time. And in 73, I began to produce this concert series in my own studio. My studio is like three times bigger than this room.
Right. So this concert still occur? I mean, it's the annual event in New York?
It's a concert series, essentially, which is in December and March, and we do, each one is one evening, so we do between 15 and 20 concerts a year.
Mm-hmm. And you're still involved with all the concerts, or do you select the artists?
I select almost all of the artists. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We just finished a series last week. So.
All right. So, and what basis do you select artists to perform on? I mean, what is your interest in art?
Well, it's experimental music, but it could be from, we just did people from all over the world. One guy was living in Japan, but he's Polish.
Mm-hmm. You're speaking of?
Karkowski, yeah. Mm-hmm. And another guy who lives in Chicago, but performs all over the world.
And you always used to say composers rather than improvisers, but I find that to be less and less so.
Well, in composers, what we do is a composer series, so we don't do musicians playing a mixed bag of composers. We do a composer who can also be a performer, but not necessarily.
So I'm interested, I was interested in these scenes. So there is probably a scene for this kind of music in New York. If you compare it maybe to Europe or Ghent, where your second home is. Is there a scene in Belgium at all for this sort of music?
Yes. In Belgium there is. The biggest place would be Berlin, by far. I mean, there's just a huge... There are probably more musicians in Berlin than there are in New York, because you can go there and live fairly well.
No, but all over Europe there's a scene.
No, but I mean, that is a particular place where there's a scene, whereas in other places people travel through and do a concert. Like in Geneva, there's a small place, a very small place, but they do it fantastic. Every week there's, one or two activities. But it's always people who are on the road, it's not people from Geneva, or so rarely.
But. Yeah, but in Paris there's a scene, in London there's a scene.
Well, but there's much less of a scene. In Paris, there's much less of a scene, and it's, again, there's a really famous place, and it's mostly people who are coming to Paris from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Berlin, that's not always so true. There's both people who come from outside coming through, but there's also an incredible range of people living in Berlin who are performing all the time. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And does this response from the crowd or the people that attend your performances varies from venue to venue or country to country?
Oh, absolutely. But there's a weird influence, which is incredible, because the internet has strewn the seeds of this music all over. Mm-hmm. So I go places like in Russia, and people know my music, and they know it through the internet. They know it because they can read about it, but also they can get the music from the internet. Mm-hmm. And that's just true all over the world. I mean, even like in South America, there's, people know of this music, and I do a concert, and some people show up and say they've heard my music, but they have my records or something. That's very weird.
This happens more in the recent years.
It's happened more and more since the beginning of the 90s, when as the internet has grown in influence, it's made an amazing difference.
Right. So maybe if you go a bit back to your music, to an outside observer, it may seem your way of working with music, it may seem pretty rigid. So you've been doing this sort of thing for almost 40 years now, or over 50 years. So what is it about this way of making music that you find the most interesting, or that is the most interesting for you?
This is the only music. The music that I make is the only music that I was ever interested in making. So there is virtually nothing else except these sound collage pieces in that 40 years, which are different from this extremely narrowly defined music.
And maybe what part of this process of making music you enjoy the most? Is it the recording sessions, or later when you...
I'll be hearing it at the end. I just finished a piece which is scored, and so I didn't have to do any work except to record parts with musicians who were playing scores in Antwerp.
In what way do you write these scores? It's probably not a classical notation.
It's very weird classical notation. Yes, it can be notes on a line, mm-hmm. or it can be just the letter for the note. Mm-hmm. But each one is, there are certain, a number of arrows up and down which tell how far away from the central tuned chromatic pitch one should play.
Right.
And so there's a big range of stuff, and there maybe are 10 parts to the scores that people play mm-hmm. through the scores. And
in improvisation music, there are many artists who follow the same idea throughout all of their career.
Mm-hmm.
But when they play with other musicians, they tend to find new stuff. But you obviously work in a different way when you collaborate with other musicians, because you basically tell them what notes to play. And
I essentially don't collaborate.
Yeah, it's
except in this case with Catherine, who's doing live visuals. I'm doing a mix of sound collage pieces. But normally I don't. I play my pieces, and I work with musicians who play with the piece.
And they don't really improvise.
But they don't improvise, or it's a disaster.
Right.
There have been people who have improvised because they didn't realize what they should be doing. We didn't have enough rehearsal or any rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a really
right.
big problem.
So you recorded with many better known and less known musicians. So how do you select who you're going to do recording sessions with?
I meet people. It's very good to have sort of real virtuoso players, because although it seems very simple what's happening, when I try to record with somebody who doesn't play well, then it doesn't work out very well,
mm-hmm.
because the material isn't very good. And so I've worked with people like Ulrich Krieger, for instance, and I've made six pieces for him, and now he wants me to make a seventh. Mm-hmm. Or with Arne de Forsa, who I've just made two pieces for. And they're really virtuoso players,
mm-hmm.
so and consider that. I mean, they really have toured a lot as virtuoso players.
Mm-hmm. So, when you do you know how the composition is going to sound before you start recording the first?
Well, there are always surprises, and it's those little differences which make the piece work in a way. So it because every player produces both a certain tone on the instrument and has certain small variations. Like some players can play a very, 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 very steady tone,
mm-hmm.
which isn't necessarily good for me, because it's better if there's slight variations,
sure.
because then
so
when you
don't
put two of them together,
the
there's a little bit of mm-hmm. shaking going on.
Yeah.
So it's, yes, I know somewhat how it's going to sound, but I'm always surprised, because it has its own characteristic. So,
mm-hmm. so maybe what instrument sounds the best for you? Or which sound do you like the most? Is there maybe some instrument?
Probably it's cello. But it really is a matter of combination. And in the past 10 years, I've made a lot of pieces for orchestras where there are many different instruments, which are mm-hmm. scored pieces. And they can sound very, very different, just because different players who aren't, you know, so well directed. But they're, when you hear a recording, again, it's sort of a mass sound. So. I made a piece which is, we're playing in Hamburg in a week from now, which was made with a strange combination of instruments. Four instruments, a violin, cello, a piano played with a nylon string tied to the piano string and then pulled with rosin fingers.
Mm-hmm.
So the piano has a really incredible sort of chattering sound. Then also an acoustic guitar bass played the same way or with an ebow.
Mm-hmm. And this was your idea to modify piano and guitar in this way?
Yes, I made a piano piece for a pianist in Berlin,
mm-hmm.
Friedel, and it was a beautiful, weird sound. And it sort of didn't work because the fundamental is disguised too much, so that if you put two of them together very closely together in pitch, sort of nothing happens because it's such a chattering sound. But in this case, with the other instruments making the drone, it's really has an amazing sound. So. Mm-hmm. I would play it tonight, but it's probably too long. Mm-hmm. But I play the piece, I think, tonight, which I made, which I played last Saturday in Antwerp. And there, I'm playing the recorded parts, because we recorded a lot of material before the concert, and we had live players plus the recorded parts. Mm-hmm. At the concert. I would play the recorded parts.
Mm-hmm. And how do you select these pieces for particular events, performances?
By the seat of my pants. There are some pieces which I think sound really good. Sometimes I will play a piece with the sound system and the space, and if I don't think it works well, I might play another piece. Frequently I play pieces where I have a live player. We didn't do anything about trying to get any sort of live player for tonight, so we won't have one.
I remember I read somewhere that you choose music you're going to play in advance, and then in video when you come to...
Yeah, I change it when I come. Well, I have to send somebody a program. And there are certain pieces which I think sound really great, so I play them much more often than anything else. So that'll probably happen tonight too. Mm-hmm. Like a piece for cello and a piece for guitar, which are as much standard repertoire. And of course here no one's heard this music live, probably.
Yeah.
And so it's a chance to to play.
Because as you said earlier, that you're going to perform some field recordings, play some field recordings.
This is the field recordings are what I do with Catherine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is a new interest of yours.
Actually, I was showing some film in Gorizia in a talk, not in a concert situation, but actually in an exposition. And I showed one film, and I realized that this is probably the first sound collage piece that I made. When you hear bird sounds and sort of rumbling of traffic or something in the background. Mm-hmm. So
this may be interesting.
1968.
This interest started now that you signed for Touch. You work with probably people on Touch label.
Mm-hmm. I don't, but none of this material has been issued as CDs. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not true. Pieces have been on very small collections.
You said that you expect people to interpret your work in their own way.
Oh, yes.
So, did you hear any interesting interpretations?
Yes, I hear them all the time, and people have very different takes. And, like, some people close their eyes and listen to the music and don't watch the film. Some people watch the film and, like, hold their ears or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
And some really huge thing in between. Sometimes the film dominates what they see because they're very into the movement of people working, and they want to see this sort of social documentary, which it isn't my intention whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But or when they hear the music, they hear it as being very sort of hostile and mm-hmm. like nervous. But other people, I saw somebody in Gorizia. And she had seen a concert a few months ago in Tilburg, Holland, and she said it was a period of her life, this is somebody who was like 23 years old or something, she said it was a period of her life where she was the most anguished and the most, you know, nervous, and she came and within an hour she was completely calm. Mm-hmm. Say something about the live video that we're doing with the sound collage mixing pieces of mine. Catherine.
Well, Phil does the sound collage pieces, which are not his music, so it's essentially field recordings of, you know, recognizable things from the environment around us. So it could be sounds of trains, motors, water, and things like this. And he mixes live. Mm-hmm. So it's never the same twice between this in different layers, and I do live video with that based on, I do live video in different ways, but the particular stuff I do with Phil is all from pre from a very large bank of pre-recorded video clips, which are very short, you know, a few seconds to maybe 2 minutes maximum, and I have 300 or 400 of them. And so, depending on how and what he mixes, I can choose which clips to mix with other clips.
So this is happening in real time?
In real time, yeah. And so all the clips I have were shot by me, as opposed to some people recycle or use historical footage or TV footage. And it's all also fragments of the environment around us. And so, and actually in the case, and I don't only work with Phil, but in the case of when I work with Phil, a lot of actually my footage was shot in the same places where he recorded the sound. It's not necessarily the sound of the exact recording he's doing, but sometimes we were on the same train or on the same boat or something. So there are things that are actually existing.
Do you use for your films a more documentaristic approach maybe, or is it also abstract?
It's quite abstract because it's very, I mean, some things are recognizable, but in general, it's such zoomed in details of things that it also becomes quite abstract, and that you can't tell immediately what it is. Mm-hmm. Would you agree about
say,
that?
You could say perhaps it's fragmented and looped. How's that?
Well, it is fragmented. It's not looped, but it has the potential. I mean, the fragments I'll choose do have the potential to loop. Often that's how I choose them. So in a sense, it's a work in visuals. It's similar to working in sound with Ableton Live, you know, where you have many loops and you can play them together or separately, and each fragment will loop.
So maybe, what sort of inputs are you looking in music that you can react to?
Well, in general, I'm interested, or what I find, it's not even what I like or what I'm interested in, is what works. So for me to do live video, somehow it works best with quite droney music and music, yeah, also with without rhythm. Without beginning or end, so many of the people I work with work like that. But I don't. So with Phil, and then with several other people, I have this project where I like, and my database is, I don't know, maybe 400 different clips that I can choose from. But with other people, I also work with live cameras, and some are acoustic musicians, and I've attached cameras to their instruments, or to their hands, or to their body, or sometimes I just have several cameras and I'm mixing between that, so there's no pre-recorded material as well. Or sometimes I can sample what they're doing and bring it back. So it's only based on recording them live during a concert, but I'm sampling at the same time, and so bringing back something they did 5 minutes ago, the image of. So, but yeah, also basically, and there's like, there are musicians that I really love to listen to concerts too, and I can't play with them.
He was saying earlier that his performance with the music, because it's played loud, can be quite hostile. So how did you get adjusted to this loud music, maybe? Because some people would say that playing it so loud, you could be seen as abusing one's body. Or...
Yeah, but I never find that with Phil. It's loud, but I mean, I
compared to the people who I consider to be loud, my music is not very loud.
No, and it's Karkowski. And yeah, I was just thinking of Karkowski, who just performed in New York, and who
the blues and speakers.
but it's, and I really agree what Phil says about his music, that it's true that if it's not loud enough, you don't hear everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. All of these, you know, microtonal interreactions. So
one interpretation could be that when it's played at a lower volume, it could be sort of pleasant. When the volume is really high, it can be even physically uncomfortable. So which reaction?
Well, but there's an incredible range of sensitivity to sound in people. Mm-hmm. So for some people, the level that I play at is not very loud at all. To other people, it's unbearably loud. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, the people who consider it unbearably loud when they leave a Krakowski concert immediately.
Mm-hmm. But I think Phil's music is very particular, and I think it's one of those things that either you like it or you don't. And I do find that the people who especially find it much too loud are people who don't really like it so much in the first place. Because most people who like Phil's music, they don't complain so much about the volume, or they come prepared with earplugs or something. But the ones who really complain are people who perhaps like Phil, but who aren't so interested in the music in the first place, I would say. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say that?
People who complain are usually people who don't know the music and don't know what they're coming for. And sometimes, like, an audience will virtually all leave. Mm-hmm. I mean, it happens. I did a concert in Los Angeles at the Red Cat Theater, and the audience which came was about two-thirds with gray hair and definitely older than 50. Mm-hmm. And almost all of them had left by halfway through the concert. And then we got down to the crowd who came to hear the music and knew what they were going to hear. So that's also the thing. People who come who don't know what they're going to hear and aren't acquainted with the music. I mean, even a lot of people come and they have heard records of mine and they realize that the record is not my music because they're playing it on their home sound system at a fairly low volume. Mm-hmm. Even if they're playing it at a fairly high volume for them, it's still a low volume compared to listening to it in a big space, reverberant space with a big speaker system.
So, mm-hmm. So you say that it's often... The performance often depends on the space. So this is
totally depends on the space, depends on the sound system.
Mm-hmm. It's really amazing. Pripilica, where you're performing, and that is quite a conventional space.
Fairly conventional and quite small, so that the kind of reverberation that I would like to have probably won't happen here. Mm-hmm. One thing I'll probably do is to turn these speakers so they face a wall and they bounce mm-hmm. in the space.
You said that you encourage your audience to move in the space usually.
It would be nice, but they, because there's film, also mostly the audience doesn't move. So the people who have the good seats, which are sort of in the middle of the space, right. They're the ones who are going to really hear the music. People who sit in the back or, mm-hmm. or you know, very far to the side mm-hmm. are not hearing. Mm-hmm.